I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:06. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Human trafficking is a major concern in our region and across the country. Not everything you hear about it is true. Later this morning, we'll debunk some of the myths about human trafficking. Earlier this morning, Washington Senior Senator Patty Murray convened a hearing on our nation's infrastructure. That hearing comes less than a month after the collapse of the I-5 bridge at Mount Vernon. Senator Murray joins us now. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, nice to talk to you today.
I know that one of the goals of your subcommittee is to get information from the Department of Transportation and other officials about the general state of the nation's bridges, highways, and other infrastructure. And what are you hearing? How would you rate that infrastructure?
Well, I think we all know the basic bottom line is that after decades of wear and tear, our nation's infrastructure, whether we're talking about our bridges, as we have been really focused on in our state, or our highways or our roads, we have a lot of work to do. And the hearing that I held today, it was to talk about what we need to do to not only prevent another collapse, but to really ask how we're prioritizing this and how we're going to fund it in the future. And I think this is an absolutely critical question for our country today. Certainly the people in our state understand the need for this.
Well, the figure that I've read is that 7,000 or so bridges across the nation are deemed structurally deficient by a National Engineering Society. Is that the tip of the iceberg?
Well, I think that's a pretty clear picture that we have a number of pieces of infrastructure that need repair or are just old. The Skagit River Bridge itself was not on the top of any priority list to be replaced, but it is an aging piece of infrastructure, and we are, of course, waiting for NTSB to give us the final report on what exactly happened there. But the fact is that we do have a lot of bridges in our own state and across the country that were rated much higher in terms of need to replace or repair. So, you know, we talk a lot in this country about our budget deficit, and we need to be talking about our infrastructure deficit. That's what I came away from this hearing really believing.
Senator Murray, do you have any sense of how much it would cost to bring everything up to modern safety codes or repair things that really need it?
I think that's really hard to assess because there's different components that you would have to look at. Many, in fact, all of the bridges like the Skagit River Bridge are actually controlled by the states that have them. They're federal investments in them, but we would have to ask every single state, and a lot of states haven't had as much infrastructure research in their own states to give us those numbers quickly. But I think we do know just from the number of reports that are out and from our own assessments that we are way behind in making sure that we prevent another collapse. In Washington State, we have the Columbia River Crossing, which is a bridge that needs to be replaced. It is old and unsafe, and it is a major piece of infrastructure on our I-5 corridor. I've actually been working on that project since Senator Hatfield was in office. He and I began discussing this more than 20 years ago. It takes a long time to get the funding in place, to do all of the component parts of making sure you've got the right permits and the right order, and it takes a long time. So even if we were to magically come up with a number today, it would take forever. Getting that number, though, is a real challenge because we are in a very tough budget climate. We need to prioritize. We need to make smart investments, and part of the policy that we need to do at the federal level is making sure that we put the top infrastructure in line in the right priority order and have the funds available.
You mentioned it takes a long time to get the funding in place. The Washington delegation, you and some of your colleagues, announced today that $15.6 million in emergency funding was coming to Washington State to fund the permanent replacement for that Skagit River Bridge. Does that cover the full cost?
Actually, the funding that Secretary LaHood announced today is really good news for the state of Washington. It fully funds the temporary bridge that is now installed at 100%. It will replace fund the permanent replacement that we will have in by mid-fall at 90%. The state will have to come up with the 10%. That's an emergency fund that we have at the federal level, but it has nowhere near the funds to be able to do the vast amount of work we have across the country. country. But it is good news that at least we have that funding in place and available from the federal government to be able to assist our state with this disaster.
After the bridge collapse and the immediate aftermath, we spoke with 7th District Representative McDermott, and he mentioned the possibility of, and I've heard this from other people, of increasing the federal gas tax, something that hasn't been done in more than 20 years. Is that, do you believe, a potential source of revenue for transportation projects?
Well, we had transportation experts in front of us at the committee this morning, and that was a key question from my colleague, Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine that is my ranking member, and I, as chair of that committee, asked our panel. There are options out there in having the funding in place. None of them is easy. There's been a lot of studies that have done. The gas tax that we have always relied on to be able to be there to fund our infrastructure, there is less in that fund today, a lot less in that fund today, because we are driving more fuel-efficient cars, so we use less gas, and as a result of that, there is less revenue coming into that fund. So, the option of raising that is something that has to be asked and talked about. There's other ways to fund transportation, but I can tell you this, none of them are easy. So we have to not only say, how are we going to fund it, how are we going to prioritize it, and how are the partnerships that fund all of these roads, bridges, and highways going to do their part? We're right now at a critical phase with the Columbia River crossing between Vancouver, Washington, and Portland, Oregon. The federal government has put in an incredible amount of money. The state legislature from Oregon has done their part. The piece that is missing that we are counting on is from our own legislators in Washington State, and they need to put their commitment up, or this project is going to go to the back of the line at the federal government, and we will never get the funding for it. So everybody has to be a partner in this, and there's a lot of different funding sources. They're all complex, but none of us can just shut our eyes and say, not in my watch.
Well, just the last question, because I know you're very busy. Is there the will in Congress? You have the will, but what about your colleagues?
Well, the Skagit River Bridge was a wake-up call for all of us in Washington State. I think we now clearly see the impact when a major artery is shut down because of a road repair. Not just in terms of the cost of replacing it, but every business near that, every family near that has been impacted. Local businesses have taken a big hit. Truckers who have to use that to get their goods to companies in Washington State and Oregon have lost the ability to do that. It is costing them a lot of money. So, yeah, we know in our state this has a big impact. Everybody has to recognize that in their own states, I don't care which state you're in, the same kind of impact will occur to you, and that's the reason that we had the hearing this morning.
Senator Murray, I thank you for taking a few minutes to update us on this issue.
Thank you very much.
Patty Murray is the senior senator from Washington State. And if you have not heard, the temporary bridge replacement is scheduled to reopen on schedule early next week over the Skagit River in Mount Vernon. This is Weekday.
It's 9:15. Buster Simpson is a Seattle-based artist who, well, a lot of his work is public art that aims to bring nature into our cityscape in unusual and creative ways. We'll learn more about Buster Simpson and what he's up to in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from City University of Seattle, a private, not-for-profit university where students can earn a master's or bachelor's degree in teaching, business, counseling, or information technology. More information at cityu.edu.
Cloudy this morning in Seattle, 55 degrees. Forecast says chance of showers through the day and an afternoon high of 69. It's 9:16. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Exploring faith, sex, love, and politics with Dan Savage in 15 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. For 40 years, Seattle-based artist Buster Simpson has delighted in provoking the powers that be. He created giant limestone tablets that he called River Rollades, and then he tossed them into the Hudson River. They were eaten away by the water, proof for Simpson that acid rain was causing a problem in our country. Simpson's also well known for putting ceramic plates in the sewage outfalls and urban waterways, then firing those plates so the pollution that they collect becomes the glaze. You can actually see it. He's proposed siting composting toilets on First Avenue in Seattle as facilities for the homeless and to fertilize street trees. And Buster Simpson was one of the first artists in residence in a Seattle City Department public utilities in this case. Now, Fry Art Museum curator Scott Larimore has put together the first ever retrospective of Buster Simpson's ongoing career. It's called Buster Simpson Surveyor. I met Buster Simpson at the museum, and one of the first things in the show that caught my eye was a video. It was a man with a giant bundle of sticks on his back. Simpson says this was one of his very first Seattle projects. The film was made in the early 1970s.
The living down on Post Alley in the National Building illegally, the wonderful Bay Building, a big wood structure, was being demolished. And I just thought it was a crime to see all this good old growth wood rendered into what I call urban faggots, kind of broken pieces of splinters of wood. And so this kind of heroic alter ego person is making their way down the alley, picking up material. The video is somewhat of a dance, but a dance that's really quite honest about the amount of weight that's on my back that's forcing me to be pretty honest about my moves.
Actually, he's sort of bent over with a big bag of sticks. He looks like a folklore hero. The same gallery also holds a trio of metal crows that rhythmically tap on padded poles. There's a long carved wooden bench and a collection of empty beer bottles. Above those beer bottles, three metal cutouts of men who look a little bit like the woodman in the video are holding long 2x4s. It's a recreation of an installation Buster Simpson made a long time ago. In The Real Thing, the metal cutout men whack and break the bottles when the wind blows the wood around. Buster Simpson is a Michigan native. He went to art school at the University of Michigan, and I asked him whether it was always his intent to be such a very public artist.
I was more interested in interacting directly. It just seemed to be, if I was to engage with site-specific process art, it's a hard commodity to commoditize, which is what you often get up against when you have other mouths to feed, with the institutions. So I think I've just worked at developing an approach that is more public. We could talk about the composting commode, which actually is a watershed that. And in fact, there's some videotape of us actually busting up the concrete and putting it in.
It was part of a whole, I'm not even sure what year it was, in the 80s. You got a commission that was part of a group of commissions, and you had this idea that these commodes would be used by the people who live on the streets in downtown Seattle, and they could fertilize the trees.
Right.
The city, there was an initial yes, and then full-fledged panic set in.
What the composting commode did is it's like an agitprop. It said, this is an issue down here. We have a lot of homeless and indiscriminate defecation going on. We have like a major, Metro was like about to build another flush toilet system, which in the long run, we have to like look at how we use water. So now we've got Bill Gates developing composting commodes to the third world, and I'm saying, hey, Bill, give us some, and how come instead of the Portland Loo, we're not using the Bill Gates result, and maybe we could sell them to Portland instead of Portland selling theirs to us, because the Portland Loo is a flush system. It is a beautiful system, and it's the next step, and it's better than what we've had here in the past, so that's good, but, let's take it a step further.
Have you always had this focus on the world around you? Did you always know that that was what your art would address?
I think we're all in it together, So what probably is good for me is good for other people. I have one piece in here I love, and we're debating whether we're going to show it or not. But it's called it's my ablution. Piece that I did a consulting gig over, and this is kind of one of those disappointments where is this another beginning of another long shaggy dog story to finally get an idea through, but I had proposed that the mosques along El Ran Highway in Doha replumb their pollution water system so that instead of going into a sewer, and water is very expensive over there, it would travel to a revered garden. And, you know, of course, I'm a kind of a guy from America and on a line to any religion. So what am I to say about this? So I actually went to Sana'a in Yemen and studied for about 4 days where for 500 years they've been practicing this very idea of diverting water from the mosques to public gardens. The wealthy 500 years ago bought up a number of plots in Sana'a in the historic district and had given them to the betterment of the society.
You had a stint, I'm not sure if it was a full year, but you were also an artist in residence at Public Utilities Department for the City of Seattle, right?
Yes, yeah. And it dealt with water issues. I also was on the first design team where artists and architects worked together along with Sherry Markowitz and Andrew Keating. You know, that is led. And then the composting commode, just recently through For Culture, I worked on the Brightwater project.
Right.
So there's always a kind of a bit of hypocrisy to me, but you know, it's that if you're not at the table, you can't leave, or you can't like maybe impact it a little bit.
You have to be an agitator sometimes within the system.
Absolutely, just like you are.
Do you feel like your agitation has moved the meter at all?
In some ways, yeah. I think it's not only me. It's if you can put something out there that's really kind of part of the gestalt that's going on, you know, what's being discussed. And it's not just me. It's like a lot of us out there that are concerned about these things. And, you know, I mean, there's the young people today. I'm quite happy to see the spirit and they're where their heads are at.
This is the first full retrospective of your work, and I wonder if, you know, you're busy, you're coming up with new ideas all the time, you've talked about how it's kind of a cumulative process, one builds on the next, but when you go back and consider the Woodman and some of these early pieces, have you thought about them since you made them, and I'm curious what it's like to contemplate 40 years of art.
Well, Woodman lives. I mean, when I did the nursing log, host analog down in Portland Convention Center, which is a bunch of, you know, a rotted wood that the Arts Commission said, we'll let you call this art, you can bring it in and let stuff grow out of it. It's a dynamic, a piece of dynamic displacement, I call it, that of, you know, there's more life in a rotting tree than there is in a living one. So there's a lot of carbon points I should be getting. I think, you know, in just other ways, this stuff keeps on coming, you know, and this show has just turned me on to like more work. You know, I'm slipping stuff in here, you know, and in fact, there's something nobody knows about across the street, but anybody can figure it out. Let me know.
That's like a game. So this isn't like a time for you to sit back and be a wise old sage?
No, I'm still learning. I'm still emerging. You know, we had a big debate whether we were going to call this a retrospective or what. I refuse to die.
That's Seattle artist Buster Simpson. The first ever retrospective of his work, called Buster Simpson Surveyor, opens this weekend at the Fry Museum on First Hill in Seattle. I couldn't resist asking Buster Simpson one last question about his art school training. I wondered whether he'd always felt a calling to address the needs and issues of the environment and the invisible members of society.
Woodstock. My first gig after art school was Woodstock Music Festival.
It was a gig?
It was a gig, yeah. I was there with 10 other artists creating installations that were to be enjoyed and used and participated on with the folks who came. The rest is history, but about all of that. Mm-hmm. But in the process, a lot of our work got, and here's that word again, appropriated, before appropriation was fashionable, by people that were there who needed, you know, firewood, bedding, and so a lot of our art that was agrarian in nature, kind of the place, got repurposed for their needs. And, you know, I mean, you come from art school and, you know, a certain amount of mystique about and respect about art, and, you know, that was a good wake-up call.
It's artist Buster Simpson. You can check out the new survey or exhibition starting Saturday, the 15th of June. This is Weekday.
It's 9:28. A conversation with Dan Savage just moments away.
Support for KUOW comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Before Midnight, starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as a couple vacationing in Greece, who continue to explore their relationship after their initial romantic meeting 18 years before. In theaters tomorrow.
There are all kinds of fathers.
He's got these huge, leathery black hands, and then you look down, and in his hands is this little baby, and there he is grooming him top to bottom.
Not all of them are human. This Father's Day, we discover the story of an unlikely dad and the lesson he gave a local woman about appreciating her own father.
You can hear that tomorrow on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Aquarium, announcing the opening of the new Harbor Seal exhibit. The exhibit provides improved access and interaction for visitors of all ages and an enhanced environment for the seals. Learn more at seattleaquarium.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:29. The director of the FBI says the government will hold Edward Snowden responsible for the NSA leak. That and more of today's news in 30 minutes.
Walter. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Sex columnist, political commentator, gay rights activist. Dan Savage is all of these things, but once upon a time, Dan Savage thought he might be a priest. And this inherent sense of morality, of right and wrong, really underlies everything Dan Savage tackles, no matter how profane the language might get. Dan Savage and his husband are the founders of It Gets Better. It's a project that aims to show gay and lesbian teenagers life isn't always full of fear and shame and bullying. They're also parents of a teenage son, a heterosexual teenage son. And as Dan Savage confesses at one point in his new book, American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics, he likes to bake, and he has or had a poodle.
I do have a poodle.
You still have a poodle.
My son has a poodle. It was our heterosexual son who introduced his gay parents to the poodle lifestyle.
But you baked before the poodle.
I did bake before the poodle.
And you
it's
were
very Ozzie and Harriet in our house. People are sometimes shocked. They come over for dinner the first time, friends of friends, and they walk in expecting there's going to be, you know, a sling over the dining room table and a couple of goats under it, and it's not like that at all.
I know, and I wonder sometimes the two sides of Dan Savage. You actually write a lot about, I didn't make up the part about becoming a priest. This is true.
It is true.
You went to a high school, a school for a while in Chicago, your hometown.
Yeah, quickly preparatory seminary north.
And preparatory to being a priest.
Being a priest. It was for Catholic boys who wanted to be priests. And as I say in the book, you know, I enrolled there in freshman year of high school, and very shortly thereafter realized I was gay. And realizing you're gay on your first day of school in an all-boys Catholic school is like realizing you're an alcoholic on your first day working at the Budweiser bottling plant.
How did you just have that revelation that day? You must have known something.
I had a creeping sense. You know, I always knew I was not like my brothers. I was not like the other boys in the neighborhood playing the reindeer games. I was sensitive and a mama's boy, and I liked to cook even then. I was baking when I was a small child. And, you know, it just to put the label on it was more difficult then. You know, gay people were less acknowledged, less discussed. And There's very little awareness about how you got to be a gay person. Certainly it wasn't covered in sex ed, as it should be, as should have been then, should be now, and still isn't. That's one of the things that promotes a lot of homophobia among young straight kids, is they think that gayness is a trapdoor you can fall through if you don't trod carefully. And then they look at the gay kids in their school, and they see them as kind of a contagion that has to be contained and beaten down. And so, you know, I had this sense that I wasn't like the other boys, and it wasn't really until high school that I put the label on it and said, oh, yeah, I am like these people that everybody says are so evil and wrong and terrible.
And you started going to these bars, which I was having some dissonance seeing this little former altar boy wannabe priest slinking around. I don't even know. Maybe you weren't slinking.
No, I was slinking. When I was a teenager, late high school years, I started sneaking into some gay bars in Chicago with some other teen gay friends. It was easier to get into gay bars then. You'd go to Maxwell Street, which was this public market in Chicago, and you could get a fake ID for $5. Absent gay straight alliances in schools, mm-hmm. absent LGBT youth support groups, absent parents who can love and support and affirm their gay children, what we had when I was a teenager was the bars. That was the gay community center. That was the only option. That was where you could be in a room with other people like you and for 5 minutes not feel like you had to be on your guard at every second. And that was not a good place to be as 15, 16, 17-year-old
no.
kid.
I was just thinking as you're talking earlier this week, Jinx Monsoon, actually Jarek Hoffer, he came in as Jarek Hoffer, the creator of the drag queen, the America's next drag superstar.
She is America's next drag superstar.
Is that the title?
She is the drag superstar. She won.
She won.
She won RuPaul's Drag Race. And she's amazing, and he's amazing. I've been into Jinx for years. Jarek is such a tremendous talent as an actor, as a performer, as a singer, as a drag queen. He's headed for Broadway. I don't think that drag is a wonderful world, and I think drag's a legit art form, but he is drag and so much more. He's a true artist.
It was interesting to me because he said at 14 in Portland, he was doing drag in clubs in downtown Portland. He's a little bit younger. That Jarek's a little younger than you.
How dare you?
Nobody can see that you're really 31 and Jarek is...
No, I'm 34 still.
You're 34 still. I was just thinking of the contrast of you kind of sneaking into these bars to steal 5 minutes of comfort to, you know, Jarek's, you know, he channeled his mother, he told me, in creating this character, which she knew about, got mm-hmm. a little bit upset about, and now, you know, is his biggest fan.
Right.
You know, it's pretty different times.
They are different times. That's often the trajectory for parents of queer kids. They don't like it. They disapprove. And then they, you know, after their kid is truly himself or herself, after they're out, parents sometimes have to fall in love with their kids again because they're so invested in this other person that their kid was even manufacturing. Because when I pretended to be straight, I had girlfriends, I had sex with girls and made sure my parents found out about it. Knowing it would upset them that I was sexually active, but knowing it would be a comfort to them that I was sexually active with females. And then when you're out and you're really yourself, you're kind of for a while a stranger to your parents. And they have to not only fall in love with this person that you now are, but always were, they have to realize that you always were that person that they were just refusing to see who you really were to protect themselves.
There's a great passage in one of the essays of this book where you talk about watching TV with your father, and I'm not sure how old you were, teenager,
yeah.
and you're watching the sitcoms.
Barney Miller.
Yeah, Barney Miller, where they're making these sort of jokes about somebody who's effeminate, and your dad is like dead silent, and you're assuming something that didn't turn out to be the case.
Yeah, my dad was a homicide cop, north side of Chicago, and was a detective, and he loved Barney Miller because it was the only show he thought on TV that showed police work for what it really was, which is a bunch of middle-aged, slightly pudgy, white guys in a room filling out forms. It wasn't chasing people up and down streets yeah. with your guns drawn. And they had a couple characters on who were, you know, the show was set in Greenwich Village, and they had a couple of, like, effeminate men who kept getting arrested, and this guy had a little poodle. And he was actually, that character was kind of very deeply human. They were acknowledging the stereotype, but embracing the human being that often inhabits that stereotype. Mm-hmm. Like, there are guys out there who are switchy, who have poodles. And my dad would sit there silent as, you know, the jokes were made at the expense of this character. And I thought, oh, he disapproves. And what he was doing was he was not laughing because he thought that if he laughed at that character, I would be hurt because he sensed
yeah, so even sweet.
Then. Yeah, but that's what comes with no communication. you know, he thinks he's being kind and I think he's disapproving. And it damaged our relationship for years.
When did you start talking again?
In my early 20s.
So you are on footing now.
Oh, I dedicated this book to my father.
Yeah.
So we're good.
It's good to
know.
But
we were estranged for a long time. And the religious right will say that, you know, I am gay because I had this distant sort of estranged relationship with my father. No, no, no. I had that relationship with my father because I was gay. We grew estranged because there was this elephant in the room, this pink poodle-owning elephant that we couldn't talk about or acknowledge. And I had to wall my, you know, inner life off from my dad and reject my father for fear of his, you know, rejection of me.
Wow, that's crazy. Like a cascade of...
A cascade of misunderstandings and assumptions.
How does that... we'll talk about your son in a little minute. I want to give a phone number if you have a question for Dan Savage, who's our guest. You probably recognize his voice because years ago, you don't have a radio show anymore. But
I have a podcast where I can say anything. It's so awesome.
Yes.
Words I cannot use right now.
Yes,
I flipped the NPR switch in my head. Yes. I'm being very good, but on my podcast, woo.
Yeah, please don't. We don't have a delay right now. 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869 or wherever you're listening, you can email weekday@kuow.org. We're talking in the calm before the storm that's sure to erupt when the U.S. Supreme Court issues rulings on defense of marriage and the California gay marriage ban, Proposition 8. You've been married two times.
To the same person.
To the same person. Married twice.
Yeah. And my husband's so nice, I married him twice. And we got married in Canada on our 10th anniversary 8 years ago now. And when the marriage equality law was passed here, we renewed our vows at City Hall on December 9th.
You know, I'm thinking about that was referendum 74. You got married in that first wave, got the permit the 6th, got married the 9th. A huge event, mm-hmm. Hundreds of people probably.
And it was my idea. I actually called the mayor and said, there's going to be all this pent up demand. Let's do pop up wedding chapels at City Hall.
And he said, sure, I'd love to.
He said, sure, I'd love to. And the stranger sponsored it. And we got Jen Zale, who's this terrific scenic designer, to do the design for the day. We raised some money to make it. Because what happens on that first day is a lot of couples like Terry and I, people have been together a long time, may have already had their commitment ceremony, had the big party with the family. Mm-hmm. They want to make it official. They want the legal rights. They want that piece of paper that the rights come attached to, but they don't want to do the whole Broadway floor show of their love again. They just want this, but to market, to have the city, you know, open the doors of City Hall, decorate or allow us to decorate that venue. And then, God, Mike McGinn and his whole staff at City Hall on that day, they were there all day. Mike witnessed so many weddings. He said the city had a certificate for each couple made out to that couple that got married that day that Mike signed. It was such a tremendous day, and all the judges who volunteered their time that day. It was a beautiful and moving day, and anyone who was in that room couldn't help but have been touched.
Or on the stairs.
Stairs, which I write about in the book.
I know, so I don't want to give too much away. We played, in promoting this interview, a little clip from your appearance on Stephen Colbert's show, and obviously it's Stephen Colbert, so there's several tongues and cheeks and tongues and all those sorts of things. Those crevices are full. But but I want you to talk a little bit, because the crux of the matter is that it does make a difference, even though you're married in Washington State. It will make a difference if the defense of marriage law is overturned.
Right. Terry and I now enjoy the legal rights that the state controls attached to marriage. If Terry dies, the body will be released to me. Isn't it romantic? You know, when people get obsessed about cakes and wedding banquet venues and things like that as the really important things. No, the really important incidents of marriage usually attach to the worst moments of your life. Being able to have the person you've picked to be your next of kin make medical decisions for you in an emergency. But if DOMA is repealed, we will have our marriage recognized by the federal government, which means if something should happen to me, Terry will get my Social Security benefits. It means that, you know, if we were a binational couple, we could sponsor one or the other of us for a green card and immigration rights. It means that we will be able to file a joint tax return instead of paying, as Terry and I do, a penalty every year because we're not married, according to the federal government, that amounts to our child's high school or college education being taken out of our bank account every year because one of us doesn't have a vagina.
Seems pretty straightforward
and
when
unfair.
You put it that way. You know, in talking to you about this, I'm flashing back maybe 20 years to when really the gay community started really organizing to push for gay marriage. It probably is more than 20 years, but that's when I remember sort of overt action. And there was a split in the gay community over whether marriage was too bourgeois to fight for. You know, wasn't that just some straight thing? And why do you want to get married?
It's like saying the law or the medical profession are male things because women weren't allowed to be lawyers or doctors. Marriage was a straight thing by dint of the exclusion of same-sex couples. The irony is that marriage has been redefined by straight people about 100 years ago. Marriage for many centuries was a property transaction with one man taking possession of another man's daughter, and in that transaction, that daughter becoming the wife and having no rights to her own body, to her own person, her own income, her own property, her own children. She was really chattel. It was slavery. And straight people redefined marriage, and credit to straight people for doing that, to mean the legal union of two legally autonomous and equal individuals who commit to one another, and they get to define everything else about that commitment. And the society culture recognizes that relationship as next of kin relationship, but whether it's monogamous, whether there are children, whether it's religious, whether it's gendered at all, that's up to each individual couple. There is no logical case you can make to exclude same-sex couples from the institution of marriage as straight people redefined it and currently practice it.
You wrote a whole book about your questions about making a commitment, though. Mm-hmm. This was prior to the first marriage, the Canadian marriage, so I'm not sure what year you wrote the commitment in, but, you know, 8 years or so ago. So it wasn't that easy.
It's a struggle for a lot of gay people. You know, you were told growing up you can't have this, and part of you goes, yeah, well, I don't want that, and you walk away from it. And for an older generation of lesbians and gay men, marriage was the trap. That was what you did when you were in the closet under duress, and then if you had a child or two, then you were really trapped for the rest of your life. And so a lot of older gays and lesbians who may have been in heterosexual relationships and may have been in marriages before they came out really regarded marriage as a plot. And then, you know, there's some radical queers who regard marriage as this bourgeois institution that we shouldn't want in. And what I try to write about in this book, and there's stuff in this book that isn't about gay people and gay marriage, but what I try to write about in this book when it comes to marriage is we can have it on our own terms. What same-sex couple wants, what we want are equal rights, not double standards. We get to define our own marriages, and we may have marriages that are a bit more gayly defined than straight people do. It just blows my mind every time a same-sex couple wants to marry, suddenly you have straight people coming out of the woodwork saying marriage is about monogamy, children, and religion, when straight people don't say that to each other. It's like straight people are allowed to marry in 2013, but I have to marry in 1813.
You define yourself in this book not only as married twice, but as, and this is a quote, America's gayest parent. I can point out the page you remember writing.
Yes, I do remember writing.
And I wondered, I'm not sure how old your son DJ is at this point, 14 or 15?
15.
He's 15 now, just finished his freshman year of high school. Mm-hmm. And I, not only are you America's gayest parent, but you're America's most famous sex columnist, which may be even more of a burden for a teenage boy than to have gay parents.
Yeah. When I write America's gayest parent, that's a tongue-in-cheek statement because, you know, I'm demagogued about by the religious right a little bit. I'm like this gay monster. You know, we're not very gay at our house unless you count some of Terry's clothing options, choices, and the musicals I like to listen to. You know, we don't, there's not a gay pride parade through our living room every night or anything. But for Deej, you know, having a parent who's gay but also a sex writer, you know, children define themselves in opposition to their parents a little bit. So Deej's kind of comically a little sex negative, and appropriately so. And as a parent, that's a relief.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
It's like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, you should wait. This sex stuff is terrible. You don't want to do it. I think, though, when my dad was, in addition to being a cop, was a deacon in the Catholic Church and the parish where I went to school, he was up on the altar every Sunday and said the homily and did mass and heard confessions and could do everything a priest did, basically, except the hocus pocus transubstantiation moment. And I was mortified. My siblings and I, we were just embarrassed that our dad was this deacon. Our dad was a priest, and we got it from the nuns in the school. We were held to this higher standard because our dad was a priest, basically. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, Deej kind of, you know, is appropriately and predictably mortified in the same way that I was by my father. So what comes around goes around.
You don't do drag anymore, though.
No, I don't do drag. But there is a picture of me in drag.
Hanging on the wall of your living room.
On the wall of my...
Under the goat.
Under the goat. In my kitchen, actually. It's a picture of Terry and I. Terry not in drag, me in drag from very early in our and after we met.
Dan Savage is our guest, and our phone number 1-800-289-5869. We had a caller who couldn't hang on the line. She wanted to know if it was okay for her to ask her 17-year-old daughter if her daughter is gay.
That's tough. I think you want to be receptive. It can be very traumatizing for a kid who thinks they're not ready to come out, and they think they're doing a really good job of hiding it, to have a parent go, come on, you are this thing your peers at school are accusing you of being, and you're being mocked for or teased about, right? You really are that. And that can be hard, and that can make a kid double down in the closet. Instead of asking your daughter if she's gay, I think it's really important to say to all of your children as they come up, that whatever you are, you know, you may be gay, you may be straight, odds are straight, but a percentage of everybody is going to be gay or lesbian, bi, trans. And I just want all my kids to know that, you know, whoever you are, I love you. And not every gay, lesbian kid is gender nonconforming in those ways that parents go, oh, yeah, like my little boy is very effeminate. Mm-hmm. He's a sissy, going to be gay. Or my daughter's a tomboy, probably likelier to be a lesbian. So I'm going to go out of my way now to communicate to that, you know, effeminate boy or tomboyish girl that I love them anyway. And there you may have a kid who is in every way a boy's boy or in every way a girly girl who is gay or lesbian. Mm-hmm. And if you don't say it to those kids too, those are the ones that you may lose.
DJ said it to you first.
DJ did come out to us as straight. I wrote about that in the book, which broke our heart a little bit, that because he was nervous about it. And we had gone, you know, we had expressed these thoughts to him, you know, whoever you are, including telling him, some gay parents can make, when I hear them talking to their kids or they write me about what they're saying to their kids, they make it sound like a coin toss, like it's a 50-50 chance you will be gay or you will be straight. And I think it's important as gay parents to emphasize to your kids that it's a dice with 95 sides, and the odds that you're going to be gay are very slim. But, you know, if you are gay, that's fine too. Some kids with gay parents who are gay feel like they're letting down their parents by being gay because of the religious rights argument that we're going to make our kids gay. But when DJ was ready to sort of come out to us as straight, I think it was complicated for him because he had insisted when he was 9 years old that he was gay because he didn't like girls at nine. And we pointed out to him at the time that 9-year-old boys not liking girls is actually a sign of future heterosexuality, not future homosexuality. When we were 9-year-old boys, we only liked girls.
Both of you?
Well, Terry more so than me, but yeah, me. I didn't like the boys in the neighborhood, but I couldn't allow myself to play with the girls because you would get beat up for that.
Dan Savage is our guest this hour, and our phone number, if you've got a question, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. I had an opportunity a couple years ago to interview you and Terry at Bumbershoot about the It Gets Better project. And we were in the Leo K. Theater at mm-hmm. Seattle Rep, I don't know, 200-300, very young audience for the most part, kind of staring at you with worshipful eyes because of the door that you opened. So I wonder how, so this is the mushy part that people don't know so much about, the part where I said this makes you a mensch for having done this. How much of the mail that you get, the correspondence you get now, is from teens that maybe Beth, their mother, isn't asking them, but you, they want to tell that they're gay?
A lot of mail from LGBT kids all over the country who are struggling. I was just in San Francisco. And I forget how long I've been doing this stuff, right? I was just in San Francisco, and this person, a young man, came up to me in the lobby of the theater at the reception and just started, like, standing in front of me and couldn't talk and started to cry. And it was because, you know, 4 years ago, when he was 17, he was living in Arkansas and gay and just tortured and closeted and didn't know what to do and very homophobic family. And he found his way to my podcast, and then he found his way to the It Gets Better project. And he heard me say to these kids, you know, you can move, you can leave, you can find your own community, you can strike out into the world, as so many of us do, that so many gay people are refugees, including me. You know, I grew up in Chicago, but I still kind of had to leave to feel free enough to be myself. And he took that advice and moved to San Francisco, and he's really happy. And he didn't, when he was 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, he didn't think happiness was in the cards for him, because of the messages he was getting from his community, from his parents, from his church. And, you know, to be approached by someone like that who, you know, credits the words that you sling out into the ether for getting them out, getting them the message they needed, helping them see their way out of this, what they thought was a trap or a locked room. That's really gratifying. And
sort of priestly of you, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I wish I got to live in a rectory. I love stained glass, but
you could always put that in your living room, I'm sure. Dan Savage is with us. We go to Bellevue, where David's holding. Hi, David.
Hi. As a straight and sports-hating teenager, I had got an awful lot of homophobic taunting pretty much every day, all the time. And I really support what the It Gets Better program is doing. But I have to wonder, is It Gets Better being used as a schoolyard taunt now?
I haven't heard that. You make an interesting and really valid point that not all victims of anti-gay bullying or violence are themselves gay or lesbian, bi or trans. It's about how you're perceived. And we have videos of the It Gets Better Project created by straight adults who were picked on because their peers perceived them to be gay in high school or middle school, as you were. But I haven't, you know, that's an interesting question that no one's ever put to me before. And I actually haven't heard that from anyone anywhere.
It was very frustrating in a way. I lived near New York City. It was the late 70s. And I remember thinking, well, if I were, at least I could get some sex.
Well, I hope that in your long straight life since then, you've managed to find some sex.
On occasion.
Thanks for your call, David. That gives me an opportunity to ask you, you're still writing the Savage Love column. How many years is
22
it?
22 years.
So you've got all this other stuff going on. Why continue with that?
Oh, I love it.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah,
just
who
for
doesn't?
Fun?
Yeah, and advice. I'm going to be Ann Landers. One day they're going to pry my advice column out of my cold, dead hands. It's just such a wonderful privilege and in a way an honor to have all these people writing to you every day. Who doesn't like to think or talk about sex? Who doesn't like to get email? And I get emails every day from people who want to talk about sex with me or share something with me or ask for my advice or my POV. And it's just really wonderfully gratifying and fun. And they pay me to do it. Why would I stop?
Okay, so that's the fun part of the job. They also call you and ask you to come and be the spokes face of sort of civil rights actions.
Yeah, I get to go on TV a little bit, run my mouth. I'm always really clear that I am not a spokes gay.
You're not the spokes gay?
No, I don't work for any gay organizations. No one elected me. I just speak for myself.
Well, in fact, you don't always come up in agreement with every gay group.
No, I don't.
Yeah, often not too happy with you. Dan Savage is with us, and we go to Kevin in Seattle. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing good. I had a question for Dan. How you doing, Dan?
I'm good.
Good. Well, I'm in the hip-hop community out here in Seattle, and I've been around for a long time and just been kind of a hip-hop head. The community that we all know of has always been kind of anti-gay in terms of how they view it, and it's always been frowned upon and not really embraced at all. And I know that there's got to be, you know, in the gay community, people that obviously love this type of music and the culture. And with the uprising of Seattle's own Macklemore, how he came out with the song Same Love, I'm mm-hmm. sure you're familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful piece and a huge contribution to the 74 push here in Washington State.
Exactly. I just wanted to know, what was your take on that? Do you think that could possibly be something that would spark something in the community that would open everybody up and say, hey, you know, this is something that we need to be a little bit more open to?
Absolutely. When you have people like Macklemore taking a stand and being open and out in the hip-hop community about their support for equal rights for queer people, that those are transformative moments. That's not going to change a culture entirely overnight, any more than, you know, one or two gay affirming parishes in the Catholic Church, which exist out there, are going to change the Catholic Church overnight. But it's the slow sort of gradual accumulation of those moments and those sorts of stands that can change a community over time. It's a generational thing, but it certainly is I think a very hopeful sign. And I'm not a big music head, but there's also that hip hop African American hip hop performer who came out and then had a number one album or number one CD, whatever those things are called. I wish Terry was here. He knows the stuff off the top of his head and I don't. And that's hugely important too, not just to have straight allies, invaluable straight allies like Macklemore out there speaking up, but also to have, you know, hip hop artists who are themselves gay and are successful as that artist is and was, and is also African-American. And I think all those things bundled together are bringing us to that tipping point. We are reaching a tipping point on LGBT civil rights and kind of coming to a cultural consensus that is increasingly stigmatizing the bigotry as opposed to stigmatizing the human beings who happen to be LGBT.
Kevin, thanks for your call. We just heard this morning, I heard at 6 o'clock while I was waiting to pick up my son from his post-high school graduation
bash.
The overnight thing they do, that the Baptist church or whatever, whoever runs the National Baptist Church, says that they won't comply with the lifting of the ban on gay Boy Scouts.
Awesome.
They won't comply. So that, what does that mean for all these boys who are, you know, maybe closeted, maybe not closeted, want to do scouting?
The thing that sort of gets lost in this case, there's not a bunch of gay 17-year-olds who are already out and been out for years who are itching to join the Boy Scouts. What happens is that somebody joins the Boy Scouts at their parents' urging when they're five. And then 8 years later, 9 years later, they realize that they're gay. And they cannot come out. And if anybody realizes or senses or accuses them, they will be drummed out of this organization that may mean a great deal to them now. It may be the focus point of all of their friendships and their social activities. And, you know, to drum out or persecute or throw out that kid if he gets outed at 16 or 15 is just cruel and vicious. It's not about adults particularly wanting to get into scouting, and it's not about children doing sex to each other, which is what Pat Robertson said the other day. It's about vulnerable kids growing up realizing they're gay and living in the heart of this institution that says who you are is unacceptable, and that is persecuting kids who are already 4 times greater risk of suicide, 8 times greater risk if their families are homophobic. We don't need to pile on. Let that kid be, and let that kid know that he doesn't have to come out, but if he does come out, he's not going to be thrown out of scouting. And that's not setting the bar too high for social tolerance and inclusion.
Dan Savage, his official title is editorial director of The Stranger. His new collection of essays is called American Savage. Still writes Savage Love, which appears in The Stranger. And Dan and NPR's Ari Shapiro are going to be at Town Hall Seattle this Sunday, 7 p.m. I'm not sure if it's sold out or not. But
There's about 80 tickets left out of the 700, so it's selling really well. There's also VIP tickets that include a copy of the book, a pre-reception with me and Ari, and cocktails from Montana and sushi from Octo at 6 o'clock. But if you go to thestrangertickets.com, you can get all that info. And can I just mention that I read about Obamacare, assisted suicide,
yes, you do.
Drug
do you,
control,
you want,
gun
do you
control.
Want to talk about all those things?
No,
now?
No. I just
we're out of time.
I just don't want the straight people to think that it's just all the gay issues. It is that and so much more.
Dan Savage, gay plus, here on 94.9 KUOW Seattle. Coming up in the next hour, human trafficking and commencement speeches.
It's 9:59. More federal help is coming to Washington State to replace the fallen Skagit River Bridge. KUOW's Lisa Brooks tells us about that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival, presenting our 11th hour, Straight Talk on Climate Change from People Who Know, June 15th at Seattle Rep, with climate scientists Kevin Trenberth and Richard Alley and journalist Andrew Revkin. Performance by Seattle Opera. More at seattlesciencefestival.org.
When Crunchab Weka started singing back